We'll hear arguments next in 1476, Bateson against United States. Mr. Repound, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The issue before the Court in this case involves interpretation of the Miller Act, which is of the utmost importance to the construction industry, and particularly those contractors doing construction for the federal government. The petitioners maintain that the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia misconstrued the Miller Act in defining the term subcontractor and in holding that the respondents may maintain this action. We feel, Your Honors, that the decision of the Court of Appeals is contrary to this Court's opinion in Clifford F. McElvoy, which was decided back in 1944, and also the case of F.D. Rich Company, which was decided in 1974. Also, Your Honors, we submit that the Court of Appeals decision for the District of Columbia Circuit is contrary to the holdings of the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, and Ninth Circuits, which have all passed on this issue. We believe those decisions are consistent with the Rich case and with the McElvoy case, and they are improper interpretations of the terms of the Miller Act. The material facts are very simple. The General Service Administration awarded a contract to Bateson to build an addition to the Howard University Hospital here in Washington, D.C., a contract of some $39 million. Bateson subcontracted to Pierce Associates all of the mechanical work, which consisted of the heating, ventilation, air conditioning. It also included the installation of an automatic fire sprinkler system. Pierce Associates, in turn, entered into a subcontract agreement with Colquitt Sprinkler Company for the installation of the automatic sprinkler system. Colquitt had a collective bargaining agreement with the respondent union, and under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, Colquitt was required to withhold certain union dues and fringe benefits from the pay of its employees and pay it over to the union trustees. Colquitt got into financial trouble, failed to pay these monies over for the period of May 1973 through December 73, and the union trustees thereupon gave notice to Bateson under the Miller Act, which is required within 90 days after the last of the work is done, and thereafter, when Bateson refused to make payment, they brought suit in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia.
Do you question that they have the same standings as would the laborers for...
Yes, Your Honor. We will concede that issue, and I think it was resolved in another case by this Court. However, we do maintain they're one tier down, and they're in a little bit different position than in the one case referred to.
Colquitt did do installation work on the job, though, did they not? They didn't simply furnish material.
That's true, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. They actually performed the installation and furnishing of the sprinkler system itself. Now, in the McElvoy case, this Court had before it the issue of whether a material man to a material man on a federal construction project was covered under the terms of the Miller Act. And after reviewing the statute and the legislative history, the Court said that the bond ran only to those material men, laborers, and subcontractors who deal directly with the prime contractor, and those material men, laborers, and subcontractors who, lacking any express or implied contract with the prime contractor, nevertheless had a direct contractual relationship with a subcontractor and who give the requisite 90-day notice. This principle is reaffirmed by this court, we believe, Your Honors, in the Rich case. The distinction in Rich was that the material man or subcontractor in that case, a company by the name of Serpac, had two contracts with the prime contractor. One contract was to furnish the plywood for the exterior of the project, and the other contract was to detail and install all of the millwork. There were some other very important facts in that case, namely that the stock holdings of the two companies were closely interrelated. The management of the two companies were interrelated. They had done work on other projects. And we believe, Your Honors, that in that case, when the court said we've got to look beyond the terms of the contract to see whether or not Serpac was functioning as a material man or as a subcontractor, that the court had in mind that distinction, and this was the purpose of applying a substantial relationship test in the Rich case to determine whether or not the middle party was a subcontractor or a material man. Thank you, Your Honors, if I might refer you to the opinion of the Ninth Circuit in that case, where the Ninth Circuit said the distinction between subcontractors and material men turns on the substantiality and importance of the relationship between the middle party and the prime contractor.
Does that really make sense to you, what you just quoted?
Your Honor, if you go back to the purpose of the Miller Act, it may make some sense, because historically, and even the District of Columbia mechanics lien law, for example, limits the coverage to a subcontractor and not beyond.
Well, doesn't that make a lot more sense, instead of talking about the substantiality of the relationship, to draw the line between the traditional material man who simply furnishes goods to the job site, which are installed by another entity, and a subcontractor who installs the stuff, actually puts the stuff into the ground that he can no longer lien for because it's public ground?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree that probably makes more sense than to apply this test in a vacuum, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals did. They misconstrued and misread what this court was talking about when they used the substantiality test, that the court in the Rich case was trying to ascertain whether this party was a material man or was a subcontractor. And they looked to both contracts, the entire relationship between the parties. And Serpac was doing contract work. They were not limited to supplying material. And that's what the court had in mind in that case. Now, the question here is whether or not Colquitt, the sprinkler installer, was a subcontractor. And we feel, in the traditional view and the traditional definition of the term subcontractor, that Colquitt was not a subcontractor. Sure, they were installing work. They were installing some of the materials on the job. But if we go back to the definition of subcontractor, which this court referred to in the McAvoy case, one who takes part of the work from the prime contractor, we maintain Colquitt is not within that category. Colquitt is a subcontractor. And these terms have been used in the construction industry and day-to-day references of the term for many years. And we believe there's a distinction between a subcontractor and a sub-subcontractor. And certainly Congress, we feel, had this distinction in mind in the committee reports, because they said a sub-subcontractor is covered by the Act, but that's as far as it goes.
You say Congress said a subcontractor is covered by the Act, but that's as far as it goes?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that was even referred to by this court in the McAvoy opinion, too.
Well, wouldn't that cut against your argument here?
A sub-subcontractor?
You don't concede, then, that Colquitt was a sub-subcontractor.
Colquitt was a sub-subcontractor, Your Honor, and Colquitt would have been covered by the Act. We're talking about the employees of Colquitt, one step removed. A Colquitt, had Pierce not paid Colquitt, certainly Colquitt could have given notice to Bateson and come in and made a claim of the Act. But we're talking about their employees. which is one step removed from Colquitt as a subcontractor.
The employees then are in your view, a step removed from in the subcontractor material.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Like a material man furnishing materials to the sub.
Correct.
Same category, Your Honor. It wouldn't make any difference whether it's employees or whether it was a material man of the sub. We say that neither of them would be covered. They're all in a third tier or beyond. You have the prime as first tier. You had Pierce as second tier. Colquitt's in the third tier. The third tier people would be covered. Beyond that, they're clearly not covered.
Of course, the difference between the employees and the material man is the employees were doing work on the project.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I don't think the distinction is important here if you look at the language of the statute itself. Now, certainly the respondents would like to say there is a distinction because these people are actually working on the project. But every bit of labor, every bit of material.
And they were doing it for a sub who could recover the contract prize.
The sub could.
Who would be protected by the Miller Act?
The sub was protected, Your Honor, and that's what Congress said in the committee report. Mm-hmm. Now, I think if we analyze the notice requirement, this would support our position. The statute requires only those persons having a direct contract with a subcontractor to give notice. And only to the prime contractor. This would leave out a subcontractor such as Pierce here. Pierce, in effect, would have no notice that Colquitt had not paid their employees. The notice would go to the prime contractor. And Pierce, of course, is one of those protected parties under the Miller Act. Pierce has a direct contract with the prime contractor and therefore is expressly covered under the Act. And the question arises in my mind, Your Honor, is why then did Congress not provide that those tiers below that first-tier subcontractor give notice to this subcontractor so that he could protect himself? In fact, in this case, if there's going to be a double payment, it would be by Pierce Associates, the first-tier subcontractor. I think it's important for the Court to carefully read the Ritz decision because I think the Ritz decision, and again, I think, too, that all of the cases which were cited in the Ritz case, I believe in a footnote, on the principle relied on by the Court to define the term subcontractor involved a situation where the party we were talking about, be a material man or be a subcontractor, had some sort of a contractual relationship with the prime. Now, there are cases where you have a prime contractor, you have another corporation, maybe a wholly owned subsidiary of the prime. And the courts in those cases have more or less pierced the corporate veil. They don't feel where you have a wholly owned controlled subsidiary that has no economic reality that a prime contractor should be able to put this barrier in there and push the material man and laborers down one tier and therefore exclude them from the coverage of the Act.
What if Pierce had gone to Bateson and said, we don't think we're going to be able to do the sprinkler work and we want your permission to assign that part of our subcontract to Colquitt? And then the same situation had developed. Would the parties be in any different position for Miller Act purposes?
Yes, Your Honor. In that situation, they would be because Colquitt then would have a contract with Bateson. And we think this is what the Court's talking about when they talk about those few contractors.
I wouldn't think that would give Colquitt a contract with Bateson. Bateson would have noticed that and would have consented to an assignment from Pierce to Colquitt.
Well, if Pierce assigned a portion of its contract work to Colquitt, then it would seem, Your Honor, that Colquitt would stand in the same contractual tier then with Pierce. They would have a contract with Bateson. They would look to Bateson for payment. Bateson could then control them and protect themselves. They could say to Colquitt, we want you to put up a bond. And, of course, if Colquitt couldn't make the bond, Bateson would then have its choice not to permit the work to be done by Colquitt.
In this case, Colquitt looked only to Pierce for payment.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Well,
Colquitt had no...
Didn't they submit their payroll to...
That's true, Your Honor, but that's a requirement on most all federal construction projects today that the payrolls go through the general contractor to the
owner.
The
issue here is whether the court below was correct in holding Colquitt to be a sub, not a sub-sub.
That's true, Your Honor. They said that technically Colquitt was a sub-subcontractor. But then they, in effect, said, this makes no difference. In fact, in the...
Well, here's what they said. They said that Colquitt, therefore, was a subcontractor within the Miller Act. That was their conclusion.
That's true, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. You will note in the Court of Appeals Opinion 2 on page... I have the slip opinion. On page 4, they said in the case before us, the union's contract was with Colquitt, which was technically a subcontractor.
Mm-hmm. But then they went on
and reached the conclusion that they were a subcontractor. We take issue with that, Your Honor. We think
well, you must, yeah. Because if he was a sub, you wouldn't be here.
We would not be here, Your Honor. I think one leading case the court should look at is the Elmer case, which was the Fifth Circuit case. And that case followed McElvoy, and they discussed McElvoy in there. And this precise issue is there. And it's simply a question of what did Congress mean when they used the term subcontractor? Were they speaking about the traditional subcontractor, one having a contractual relationship with the prime contractor? Or are they talking about any person who does both labor and material, as distinguished from a pure material man?
Mr. Repon, I don't find in the briefs any discussion of what the normal rule is in the mechanics lien law of the big commercial states like New York and Illinois and California. Would the employees of a subcontractor normally be entitled to protection under state mechanics lien law in situations like
this? Mr. Justice Stevenson, the only jurisdictions I did check out were the local jurisdiction, Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. The D.C. Code...
I know you say D.C., they would not...
D.C. has a definition of the term subcontract in the statute itself. It's section 38103 of the D.C. Code. And it's defined as any person directly employed by the original contractor, whether as a subcontractor, material man, or laborer, to furnish work or materials in the completion of the work contracted for as aforesaid.
And I understand that's the rule in the district. Do you have any idea what the law generally is?
Law generally, Your Honor, in my own experience has been, it only goes down to that first level. I know
yes.
In Virginia it's that way.
Mr. Repin?
Yes, Your Honor.
You also, I noticed, you didn't cite any law from the fast-growing southwestern states like Colorado and Arizona.
There was no slight intended, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. We had our hands full here with the District of Columbia, and we thought... This is where we need some clarification.
Is it usual for the main contractor to require his own consent for subcontracting?
Well, in the contracting procedures, Your Honor, normally the big contractors, your mechanical, electrical,
yes.
The concrete or structural, unless the general contractor does that. And that's 95% of the work.
Yes. But then there's this, how about in this case?
In this case, I think the automatic sprinkler work is sort of a specialized work. Most mechanical subcontractors will not do it.
Was the subcontractor free to sub that to anybody?
True,
he
Your
to?
Honor. True,
without
Your Honor.
Without the main contractor having anything to say
That's
about
correct,
it?
Your Honor.
Could the main contractor have required the sub to put up a bond?
They could have required it, but...
The court held that the main contractor could have protected itself.
They could have required a bond here, Your Honor, but it's clear also that Colquitt could never have obtained a bond. And this is one of the problems as you get down in the lower tiers. These people simply are not bondable. There's no way you're going to be able to get bonds. They're further down. They're usually small companies.
But if Basin leaves it to Pierce to do the mechanical and leaves Pierce free to sub out part of the mechanical, they more or less run that risk, don't
That's
they?
Right. They could not require Pierce to secure bonds from all of their sub people. They had no privity with those people.
No, but they did require Pierce to provide a bond, didn't they? And wouldn't Pierce, if it had known that this... Pierce is really the one who's going to get stuck here, isn't it?
That's true, Mr.
Chief. And if Pierce had realized how the Court of Appeals is going to decide this case, it pretty surely would have required a bond from Colquitt, wouldn't it?
Well, they would have, Your Honor. Of course, they were relying on what they believed to be the law
sure,
at the time,
right.
The Ummer case and the other cases and the way they interpreted the decision.
Well,
the
law
this
wouldn't
court.
Have... No, the law, then, as it was then, would they would still be stuck if Colquitt went belly up.
Well, as a practical matter, Your Honor, the only way that someone in Pierce's position could protect themselves would be to withhold payment from Colquitt. And this is really contrary to the intent of the Miller Act. The subcontractors simply can't afford to man these jobs if the big subs are going to hold up their payment. And that's the only way they can finance these jobs. And this is the only way, as a practical matter, I think, that a major sub such as Pierce could protect itself. Colquitt was not bondable. In fact, there was a requirement under the collective bargaining agreement that Colquitt put up a bond to protect the trustees on the very payments which are an issue in this case. The trustees waived this bond requirement, and they admit that the reason they waived it, there was no way Colquitt could secure a bond. And this is the problem. What would happen is that the industry is going to be limited to those people who have the financial and size ability to demand these major projects. We believe, Your Honors, that when we're talking about those few contractors that the general contractor can protect himself against, we're speaking of the major subcontractors, the mechanical, the electrical. But you have some very specialized subcontractors, particularly on the federal projects being constructed today, security systems, security glass, locks for a jail, and it goes on down the line. Now, these are being furnished and installed. Theoretically, they could come within the definition of subcontractor as defined by the D.C. Court of Appeals, but we think that Congress never intended that the prime contractor would have to protect himself against these many hundreds of small subcontractors.
Well, counsel, isn't it fair to say, though, counsel did generally intend to provide the same kind of protection that would be available under state mechanics lien law if it were not for the sovereign immunity of the federal government?
Mr. Justice Stevens, that's exactly correct.
Isn't it relevant to know what the general practice is throughout the country on this sort of problem? Nobody seems to have talked about it, and I don't mean to single out any one jurisdiction, but isn't that what Congress was trying to do?
That's exactly what they were doing, Your Honor, because there was no way you could enforce a lien against government-owned property. The mechanics lien law, you enforce your lien by ordering a court sale of the property. This couldn't be done in the case of federally owned property. As I said, Your Honor, the jurisdictions that I'm familiar with all have some limitation. And traditionally, I think it's only going down to the first tier, the subcontractor. It's that way in the District of Columbia. It's that way in Virginia. And I think it's that way in Maryland. And it seems to us that this is what Congress was replacing when they enacted the Miller Act. And certainly when they put limiting language in there and use the term subcontractor as well as subcontractor, that they're trying to go down to a specified tier. But the Miller Act goes one tier further than most state mechanics lien laws.
It says any state mechanics lien laws don't pay off, according to you, any worker who works on the project?
No, Your Honor. That's exactly what I was reading here in the D.C. Code. It's any person directly employed by the prime contractor only. Mm-hmm. His employees, his subs, his material men. That's as far as it goes. And I think this is true in Virginia, too. Under the Miller Act, we have those people who have a direct contract with the prime contractor. That would include the laborers of the prime contractor, the material suppliers, and the subcontractors. Then we have any person having a direct contract with a subcontractor. So it would be the material suppliers, the sub-subs, laborers to a sub. And did I mention material men to the sub? Beyond that, we think that that's what this court meant when they said those in more remote relationships.
So in Virginia, Pierce's employees who had worked on the job installing other mechanical stuff would not have any laborer's lien claim.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I think that's true. There is no mechanics lien. There is other statutory protection, but it's not under the mechanics lien law.
That would not be true in Arizona. I know the law would be different, that they would have a claim.
Pierce would.
Pierce would, Your Honor. Pierce is a subcontractor. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it becomes even more difficult, though, in a state like, I think, Virginia and Maryland, where the general contractor has paid the subcontractor, this will extinguish the mechanic's lien rights so that the rights are somewhat limited. And it was quite obvious that this was what Congress was attempting to do, and it, Your Honors realize it started with the Hurd Act, which was the forerunner of the Miller Act. However, the proviso was interjected into the Miller Act, and this is what the court had to interpret in the McAvoy case. Following McAvoy, as I mentioned earlier, there are at least four circuits that have ruled precisely the way we're asking this court to rule today. And we think also that the Rich case did not alter the test in the McAvoy case. All Rich said was, here we have an issue. Is this man really a material man, or is he really a subcontractor? The man I'm speaking about was Serpak. Serpak had a very close relationship with the prime contractor. Obviously, the prime contractor could protect himself. Please, Court, I'd like to reserve what little time I have.
Very well.
I don't think I understand this case at all. I thought I did.
Mr. Capitano?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. If I may, at this point, I would like to respond to Mr. Justice Stevens before I get into my argument. You asked, sir, whether the state mechanics lien laws cover this problem, and you did not see any discussion of it in the brief. It is our view that when Congress adopted the Miller Act, the main purpose, or in fact, as Chairman Miller stated in the legislative history, the purpose of the act was merely to correct the procedural problems in the Hurd Act. So they weren't adopting the Miller Act to try to conform it with state mechanics lien laws. They were trying to correct the procedural difficulties in the Hurd Act. Those difficulties were that there was only one bond, the government had the first opportunity to sue, contractors had to wait 6 months before they could sue, all of the suits had to be joined in one proceeding. These items or difficulties made it impossible for contractors to collect their money on government jobs. And as a result, they were forced to settle for a lot less than what their claims were worth. That was the purpose of the Miller Act. And under the Hurd Act, anybody who supplied labor or material to the job was entitled to go against the bond. In other words, it was not there was not a question of privity involved, as we submit the petition.
But was it not correct that the original Hurd Act was intended to provide a substitute form of protection for that normally available under state law by way of mechanics lien?
I believe that's generally correct. Yeah. And, of course, the Hurd Act covered everybody who supplied any labor or material on the job.
And your point is the Miller Act was liberalized the act by requiring a payment bond as well as a performance bond.
Yes, in that sense. Now, I do recognize that in the Miller Act, a limitation was imposed with regard to this proviso that the petitioner is relying upon. But in our view, the Miller Act did not change in the sense the class of people who could be covered. What the Miller Act did was provide an opportunity for a general contractor or a prime contractor to protect himself from remote claims.
Mr. Capuano?
Yes, Mr. Capuano.
If Colquitt had simply delivered sprinkling equipment to the job and Pierce's employees had installed it, would Colquitt's employees or their pension fund have had a claim under A, the Hurd Act, or B, the Miller Act?
Under the Hurd Act, yes. Under the Miller Act, no. Because Colquitt's employees would be in the same situation they are in this case. Now, the trustees who brought this suit are trustees of a jointly administered pension, welfare, and apprenticeship fund. In other words, they're equal number of employer and union trustees on this fund, or actually there are three funds involved. The money that they were trying to obtain was the contribution that Colquitt, in his collective bargaining agreement, promised to make to these funds every month on behalf of the employees to fund their pension benefits, health insurance benefits, and educational benefits. In addition, the union is a respondent in this case and was a plaintiff because Colquitt withheld money from the wages of the employees, part of which was to go towards union dues, and the other deduction was to go to a vacation savings plan, set up individual savings accounts in banks for each employee. Of course, the employees never got this money. Now, it's our view that what the Court of Appeals did here was look at the facts in the case. For example, it found that the sprinkler system installed by Colquitt was specifically required by Bateson's contract with the government. It found that sprinkler system was an integral and significant part of the whole building. It found the work that Colquitt did was performed over a substantial period of time. And it found that the work was important. And in support of that, it showed, or the court pointed out, that the work done by Colquitt's employees was taken over by Pierce when Colquitt went broke or was unable to perform anymore.
Well, all of those things could be true of a identity that was concededly a sub-sub-sub-sub-contractor, which you would concede would not be under the terms of the Miller Act.
No, I would not concede that, Mr. Justice Stewart. No, the point is that applying this court's test in Rich, the Court of Appeals said you look to determine whether there's a substantial and important relationship between the prime and this other party, the defaulting party.
Even though this other party is a subcontractor to the ninth degree.
Well, the point is you don't look at privity.
Let's just concede.
Yes,
that.
All right, say it's to the ninth degree. Yeah. You look to see whether there is this substantial important relationship.
If these attributes exist, then he is functionally a sub-subcontractor.
No, he is
at least
subcontractor.
A subcontractor, at least.
Under the prime and his employees or any person who deals with him are covered. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that this court, in our view, adopted this substantial and important test was because the legislative history makes clear, and the court has repeated it many times here, that the purpose of the act was to protect the interest of those who supply labor and material to a federal project or a public project so that they can get their money. Now, certainly, if that is the purpose of the Act, the only reason for having the proviso in the Act is to protect a prime contractor from some claims which are totally remote, something he couldn't protect himself against.
Don't you have real difficulty, though, when you try to break it down under an abstract description like that as to just who is covered and who isn't?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, no, I don't have any problem with that at all because the test that this court set up in Rich and followed by the Court of Appeals is really no different than tests that the court has set up in other situations. For example, a reasonable man. I don't believe this test is any more difficult than a reasonable man test. There are going to be close cases under this definition, but we submit that if you adopt the mechanical test, which the petitioner is proposing here, what you wind up with is the employees and other persons who supply labor and material being the ones who are suffering as a result of delegation or self-delegation or a sub-delegation of work on a construction project. In other words, if I may, in this particular case, Pierce subcontracted out the sprinkler work. Now, it's not at all uncommon in a large government project where the mechanical contractor will sub out the sprinkler work, he'll sub out the underground utilities, he'll sub out the sheet metal work, He'll sub out the pipe covering work. He'll sub out the temperature control
well,
work.
Maybe I didn't speak while asking my question. I joined Rich, and I certainly understood it to focus on whether or not the person was a subcontractor as opposed to a material man. And it used the close and substantial, whatever the language is, which I think had come originally from McAvoy. But I understood your argument to be that we can more or less discard this distinction between material men and subcontractors and simply focus on this rather abstract descriptive language.
Mr. Justice, if I understand your point, it is that Rich was only making a distinction between material man versus subcontractor. If that's so, we would still submit, although I do believe the test goes further than that in Rich, but we would still submit that the approach the court used in Rich, that is a functional type test, is the only test that is going to accommodate the two purposes that we understand to be in the Miller Act. The first and primary purpose is to protect those whose labor and material go into the public projects. The second purpose of the proviso to the Miller Act is simply to make sure that the prime contractor has some means of protecting himself from remote claims. Now, not remote claims in terms of number of tiers people are down, whether they be 1, 5, or 10, but remote in the sense that the defaulting party does not have a substantial and important relationship with the prime. Because if he does have that kind of relationship, then there is no reason to eliminate contractors down this.
What about security guards hired by the prime who contribute nothing to the on-the-job construction but patrol it regularly while it's under construction?
Well, if they had a contract direct with the prime, I believe they would be covered under the Miller Act. There'd be no issue about that.
You think they would be covered?
I don't think that's the same type of case we're talking about.
No, I certainly don't either. But you think they'd be covered under the Miller Act?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
Mr. Capuano, on your remoteness argument, which is very persuasive, but the problem that I have is what about the House report, which seems to draw the line one step short of where you take us?
On the language referring
the
to the
subcontractor.
Yes.
But that's as far as the bill goes. What do you say
about
that?
Well, my answer to that would be, first, that at best it's ambiguous because the Act itself doesn't define a subcontractor. So with the Act not defining a subcontractor, it is difficult to assume then that the House report, when it refers to subcontractor, was referring to a definition which the petitioner urges here. In other words, I think the functional definition that this Court laid out in Rich is a more appropriate one. Furthermore, I believe that, again, as this Court has pointed out many times, there is extensive legislative history on the other side of this problem, and that is the legislative history, and in fact, comments by Chairman Miller, one of which I mentioned earlier, that the basic purpose of the Miller Act was merely to straighten out these problems with the Hurd Act. Now, with that being repeated over and over again in the legislative history, I find it difficult to attribute to Congress then, by that one statement in the House report, a wholesale elimination of classes of people who were previously covered. In effect, to adopt that statement as some sort of controlling criteria would mean that Congress decided they were going to cover just the tip of the iceberg and eliminate all these other people that previously be covered. I believe that before we could look at that statement as controlling, there would have to be far more legislative history similar to that, or at least defining what they meant by subcontractor in that case. If I may, the point I would like to make with regard to the remoteness argument, and I believe I partially got into it, But I would like to stress the fact that I do not believe that Congress can be assumed or can be presumed that Congress intended, when it adopted the Miller Act, to let coverage under that act be controlled by the contractors who were on the job. And basically, if we adopt petitioner's contention, that is what happens. If Pierce decides to do the work himself, Pierce's employees are covered. If Pierce decides to subcontract that work to Colquitt or somebody else to do the work, Colquitt's employees aren't covered.
That's true under what you say Congress did not intend in the Miller Act is true under most states' mechanic lien statutes, is it not?
There are many that do that. There are a few, Justice Rehnquist, which we have found, which would, in effect, support our position.
And yet, didn't you say that the Hurd Act, as originally drafted, was intended as a substitute for state mechanic lien statutes?
Yes, in the sense that you could not have a mechanic's lien on a federal project, the Hurd Act provided for the bond to give the laborers and other persons who supplied material on the job opportunities to collect. But I think this point is particularly crucial, that the rights of both laborers and material men to seek recovery under the Miller Act bond, under the petitioner's contention, rests on how much subdelegation the prime or someone, for example, in Pierce's condition, decides he wants to do on the job. This, we submit, is totally inconsistent with the Rich case. And for that reason, we believe that the Rich case, even if it is not found controlling in this situation because it involved a supplier to a material man, we believe the test itself is sound and was stated as a general test for determining subcontractor under the Miller Act, and the functional aspects of it can be applied in this situation. There are a couple more points I would like to make if I could. Another factor which I think demonstrates that the petitioner's privity type argument is not valid in interpreting the Miller Act is the situation we have here where Pierce took over the job after Colquitt was unable to perform. Now, under the petitioner's theory of the case, on the last day these people worked for Colquitt, they were not covered under the Miller Act. They had no bond coverage. The next day, when they went to work for Pierce, doing precisely the same work, probably hooking one piece of pipe up to the piece of pipe they hooked up yesterday, they were then covered.
Yes, but isn't that a natural consequence of the kinds of line drawing that we encounter in a whole range of business and commercial relationships?
That is the kind of line drawing, yes, Mr. Chief Justice, but my point is that line drawing based upon these relationships in business, in other words, what Pierce and Colquitt want to do and what Bateson wants to do with them, should not be controlling in interpreting the Miller Act, because Congress there said, look, we want to make sure people whose labor goes into that building get paid.
Well, in states, lien actions, frequently the central issue or the only issue is whether the work or the material was completed on Monday of a given week or Tuesday. And there's an arbitrary line drawn under a statute.
Well, those lines, as I recollect, Mr. Chief Justice, really are concerned more with whether someone was prompt in getting his claim filed. For example, whether the work was done Monday or Tuesday.
It's the same general kind of line drawing, isn't it?
No, I would respectfully disagree, Mr. Chief Justice, that I think the line drawing there.
Well, you don't lose your case if you. I'm just surprised that you would want to put so much weight on that kind of a point. You don't lose your case on it.
Well, yes, I realize that, but.
But you want us to draw a line too, don't you?
No, Mr. Justice Marshall, I do not want
you to let it float.
Pardon me, sir?
You're going to let it float?
I want you to adopt a test, as the Court of Appeals did below, which says, look, we look at the facts, and to determine if there is this substantial and important relationship, because there's only one reason why you want to find out if there is that relationship. Because if there is such a relationship, then the defaulter is not remote from the prime.
Well, then how do you compute a Miller Act bond premium if you've got that vague a test?
The Miller Act bond premium, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, is set in the Act. In other words, the Act provides the limit of the bond.
I'm not talking about the amount of coverage. I'm talking about the premium that the general has to pay to the insurance company to get the bond.
The premium, as I recall from the brief submitted by the Surety Association, is based upon a percentage of the bond. In other words, I believe it's 0.5% for the first million or some figure like that. They did also point out in that brief that they do not compute these premiums on an actuarial-type basis. But, again, I don't believe that is crucial, because what we have to keep in mind is what Congress intended to do when it adopted this statute. Certainly, if Congress was concerned, for example, about how the sureties were going to get their premiums or how they were going to base their premium, it would have been simple to say we're not going to have any bonds. Then there'd be no premium.
Well, and Congress could likewise have passed a law that had none of the limitations that the Miller Act had in it and simply said that anybody who has come near the project and it hasn't been paid can recover under the bond. We both agree it has done neither of those things.
It has not been, no, it did not go that far. That's correct. But I would point out that if Congress fully intended, as petitioners argue, to limit the bond to the first tier, that would have been very simple to say in the proviso. But it did not say so. On the contrary, however, if, again, as petitioner argues, that Congress could easily have said who was covered, it would have been very difficult to put that kind of language in the proviso. You would have then had language sub, or sub of the first, second, third, fourth tier. That type of language, I don't believe that we can attribute to Congress that intent in view of that.
Did Pierce file a bond in this case?
Did Pierce have a bond?
The sub, yeah.
Well, the record doesn't reflect that, Mr. Justice White, but Pierce had an indemnity agreement with Bateson to indemnify Bateson in the event Bateson did.
So that, but in any event, these employees have no claim against Pierce.
They have no claim against anyone at the present time.
Well, I know, but they had, but there no bond that Pierce filed covers them.
No, no, sir. The the problem that Bateson claims exists, and that is, how is he going to be able to get all these bonds that we're going to be bonding contractors down the road? We don't believe exists, because there are several ways that Bateson can protect himself, one of which, of course, is requiring bonds. He required one of Pierce. That certainly proves he can do it. He did not have to do it. Pierce could certainly have required one of Colquitt. Now, why Pierce did not require one to Colquitt, the record doesn't show. Counsel indicates it's because Colquitt couldn't get bonded. Well, if that's so, in effect then, Pierce is telling the employees, I want Colquitt on the job. He probably had a low price. Colquitt can't get bonded. So if Colquitt goes belly up, who's going to bear the risk of that? You employees. I simply cannot attribute that intent to Congress. Now, with regard to the argument that was somewhat touched on by counsel and argued extensively in the briefs, and that is that the interpretation they are suggesting would be more fair to small contractors, that the interpretation we're proposing would in effect eliminate small contractors from coming on jobs because they couldn't get bonds, and people like Pierce from now on would require small contractors to get bonds. I think the argument is not appropriate in this case for several reasons. First, these small contractors can really be on both sides of this question. They could just as easily be claimants as they can defaulters. For example, if Colquitt had subbed out half of his sprinkler system job to a small contractor, that small contractor would be standing in the shoes of Colquitt's employees and also would come up empty-handed. So I doubt if a small contractor is going to take much comfort in petitioner's argument that we want to get you on the job even though you can't be bonded, and then have that same small contractor find out that when he can't get paid, he can't go against the bond either. Furthermore, we don't believe that the philosophy of the Miller Act was that the employees should bear the responsibility for a marginally weak contractor. Certainly, the federal government has provided other means to get jobs for small contractors on federal projects.
But you would make the same argument, I gather, for Colquitt's material men.
Oh, yes, sir. My argument would be precisely the same for Colquitt's material men. For anyone who had a contract with Colquitt, because that is the only privity which the Act requires in our view.
Because Colquitt, you say, was correctly held to be a subcontractor.
By the court below. Yes, sir. The only privity that is necessary is a privity between the claimant and the defaulting party. The Act does not require privity between the defaulting party and the prime to show that the defaulting party is a subcontractor. I have concluded my argument, and I would simply like to request that the Court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals, which we feel fully adopted the decisions of this Court in Rich and McAvoy and properly construed the Miller Act. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Raffin?
May it please the Court, very briefly. One of the very difficult problems we have with the test urged by the respondents is that it's an unworkable test. Here we had a $39 million contract. The sprinkler work was approximately $155,000, $156,000. If we use a substantiality test, let's assume we had sprinkler system in one room and it was $10,000. Are they a subcontractor? Suppose it's $500,000. Are they a subcontractor? And who's going to make these determinations? Is this going to be the general contractor, who obviously is not in a position to do so because they're not awarding these subcontracts? It's going to have to be the subcontractor, and in turn his subcontractor on down the line. And we believe, Your Honors, it's really, truly an unworkable test. As far as drawing the lines, we think this Court recognized that Congress and the Miller Act drew the line. Now, rightly or wrongly, it may well be that extension of the Miller Act should be broadened. But we feel this is a matter for Congress. If they feel this way, they can redefine the coverage. But we think the way it's defined right now, this was an attempt by Congress to draw a line, to show some definition. And we think the Court of Appeals decision violates that boundary line. In effect, it eliminates the proviso of Section 2 of the Act, which this Court had before it in the Rich case, in the McAvoy case, and which was the proviso involved in all of the circuit court opinions, who held that a subcontractor is a subcontractor in the usual meaning of this term. And this term was used in the building trade industries, and certainly this Court recognized that in McAvoy, and we think this is what Congress meant when they said subcontractor. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Case.